Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating violence in Ukraine and speak with the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, Matthew Rajansky, who is an expert on the states of the former Soviet Union, in particular Ukraine. We will discuss the rising death toll and whether or not the targeted sanctions the EU are imposing on the regime's leaders and oligarchs who support Yanukovych will cause some of the oligarchs to switch sides if they want to travel to the West to visit the hordes of cash they have stashed abroad. Then we'll look into the ousting of the head of Nigeria's central bank, who blew the whistle on $20 billion that are missing and cannot be accounted for out of the $67 billion in oil revenues the state-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation received from the sale of oil between January 2012 and July of 2013. The former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, John Campbell, the author of Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, joins us to discuss the entrenched high-level corruption inside of the opaque state oil company and how it impacts the largely impoverished 170 million Nigerians already beset by a bloody insurgency that could lead to a civil war between the Christian South and the Muslim North. Then finally, we'll examine the president's decision to drop the chained CPI Social Security cut from his 2015 budget and speak with Eric Kingston, the founding co-director of Social Security Works, which launched and staffs the Strengthened Social Security Coalition that he co-chairs. We will discuss the possibility that Obama may have recognized the futility of trying to reach out to the Republicans and in this election year will show some moral leadership to help elderly, poor, and unemployed Americans who have been sacrificed on the altar of deficit reduction at a time when deficits are falling to record levels. And joining us now is Matthew Rajansky, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was the deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rajansky.
Thanks, Ian. Happy to be with you.
And it seems at this point, with the real bullets being used, there's been some, obviously, the Maidan has become militarized, and the situation at this point, at least the use of firearms, there was some restraint in that regard. Once that really breaks down, you could have a serious conflict, could you not?
Yeah, I think we're at a point where maybe it's not all bets are off and outright war, but it's surprisingly and dangerously close to that. And I think the thing that worries me further is that I don't really see the effectiveness of any of the measures that are being taken or threatened by outsiders. In other words, there don't seem to be levers that we can pull from the outside to de-escalate the situation, and that's very troubling.
Well, wouldn't, though, the sanctions, if they're targeted by the EU against, first of all, apparently the Yanukovych regime is a kleptocratic regime, and the eldest son, the dentist, apparently has been shaking down all of the oligarchs and basically saying, I'm your new 50% partner, and getting most of the government contracts. What if some of these key oligarchs who still support Yanukovych could be peeled off? Would that make some difference if their assets abroad and ability to travel were curtailed? Wouldn't that get their attention?
You're getting right to the heart of the issue. The answer is maybe. We don't know. And that's because it's a very delicate situation when you start to try to apply pressure on these quite powerful, somewhat unpredictable relationships between the oligarchs and the ruling authorities. Remember, you're exactly right. Some of them are alienated now from Yanukovych. Others of them have cut deals. But the question is, what kinds of sanctions can you threaten or impose against them that will not go over the line of hurting ordinary Ukrainians, isolating and alienating Ukrainian society at large? Remember, the vast majority of people are still not out in the streets, and you don't want to put them in a position where they feel that the international community and the West in particular have been callous towards their suffering. But at the same time, you want to act in a way that's likely to de-escalate things. And I worry that with the oligarchs, you may force a couple of outcomes that would be unintended. One, it could become a kind of a litmus test. If you don't fall subject to the sanctions, then the regime will take further steps against you. So you, as a businessman who might otherwise be quite reasonable, ready to talk, you'd sort of clam up and you would adopt a harsher position. And I think second is we really don't know. Some of the oligarchs might cut their own separate deals with the Russians. Some of them may begin to intervene. Remember, these are heavily armed camps, and they may begin to intervene as well in ways that could lead to widening of the violence. So it's starting to play with fire. It goes well beyond the visa bans that have been announced so far.
But my understanding is that one of the things that's propelling the disgust and unrest in the country is this kleptocratic family and their excesses. It's really, in a curious way, it's similar to what started the Arab Spring. The Tunisian people just got disgusted with this the tacky embezzlement of the ruling family.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of frustration throughout Ukrainian society about that. But on the other hand, what you're seeing today is tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who are willing to risk life and limb to make a statement and fight against that corruption that they see. What we have not yet, after 23 years of independence, seen in post-Soviet Ukraine is a willingness on the part of 10 or 20 million people to endure minor discomfort, to cease paying bribes and thus impose rule of law from the bottom up, to stand up when they see businesses being stolen, when they see the shakedown that you talked about. It's not just the president's son. It happens at low levels all the time throughout Ukrainian society, and to defend their own democracy, that is, by voting, by taking elections seriously and not selling their votes as many Ukrainians do. Again, I don't mean to indict all of Ukrainian society here, but there's a very troubling amount of cynicism and passivity among the vast majority of Ukrainians at the same time that you do have a few people or a few thousand people who are willing to take extreme measures.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rudzianski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Belarus, Moldova, and Ukraine. So if indeed you have a kind of moral rot in the country, and perhaps it is a result of the same kind of moral rot that existed in the Soviet Union that eventually brought it down. But I also understand, at least in the western part of Ukraine, there's always been a distaste for the Soviet Union and a not so much a hatred, but certainly a leeriness, if you will, of Russia. So how do you reconcile those two?
Well, look, I think it's true that there are real differences in attitude and in geopolitical orientation between Western and Eastern Ukraine. But that moral rot that you were talking about, the kind of fundamental unwillingness to endure relatively minor sacrifice but on an ongoing basis in order to do the hard things that are required to build an economy and to build a successful state of governance where the precedent, as you pointed out, is the Soviet precedent, which is a terrible precedent. That's pretty universal across Ukraine. That's Eastern and Western, Central, Southern, and I think the only real difference that I've seen is that there is a younger generation, a fully post-Soviet generation, some of whom have had experience abroad, who are really prepared to do things differently. I mean, I have friends who have tried to open businesses and really refuse to pay bribes, and they've encountered big problems but are nonetheless persisting. I think I would put my hope in that generation. It's not a silver bullet, and it's not going to change overnight, but I would much rather see that kind of bottom-up groundswell transformation than I would see a sort of seizure of power by a Western-oriented group, but through violence, which results inevitably in disappointment, because you know individual political leaders in Ukraine have always ended up disappointing us, whether they're pro-Western or pro-Russian or just pro themselves.
So, but there seems to be an essential problem here, and as much as Putin and the West are talking past each other, Putin clearly sees this as a geopolitical struggle, when it seems pretty clearly to be an internal Ukrainian struggle. Do you think that Putin knows this? I mean, what is he just playing to the gallery? Does he have any concept of how much this is about Ukrainians fighting or at least struggling over two sort of somewhat different models of governance, one, of course, that is the Russian model and the other one that's a European model? At least that seems to be pretty clear that this is internal dissent, not, as far as I know, in spite of the phone call from the State Department official to the U.S. ambassador that the Russians clearly leaked and the presence of EU people. At the end of the day, I don't think the West is not asking Ukraine to join NATO or anything, are they? I mean, this...
No, I think that's right. I think Putin is acutely aware of the reality that Ukrainians are fed up, or that, let's say, those Ukrainians who are protesting are really fed up with the kleptocratic model of post-Soviet governance. But I think he's cynically and smartly using the situation, particularly the situation as it was, you know, a couple months ago before it turned really, really bloody and gruesome, which goes, you know, is way over the Rubicon, I think, for all sides. But when it was just kind of chaos in the streets, disorder, bad for business, essentially, he was able very effectively to make the case to his own population and in particular to his own oligarchs to say, you know, isn't our system better? You know, we may not have this kind of European-style liberal democracy and pluralism, but who needs it if it leads to this chaos? And on the notion that the West is calling the shots and intervening, I mean, it's patently absurd on its face because, of course, if we were, why on earth would we have called the shots to result in shooting? I mean, and similarly, I think for the Russians don't want a bloodbath in this country that's extremely close to them in every way. It really isn't good for business. But that said, you know, the old Soviets saw that the CIA, you know, makes the world go round. This sort of, it's called konspiratsiya in Russian, that everything is a deeper truth, a deeper story beneath what you see. It plays very well. And I think it plays well in Russian-speaking Ukraine, and it plays well in Russia.
So is that to say then, Matthew Rzhensky, that Putin would be happy to see this situation unravel in a kind of way to make a point that this is what you get from Western liberal democracy, just chaos?
No, I don't think he wants to see the situation deteriorate beyond where it is. I think two things have changed dramatically. One is the point's been made, the precedent point about, you know, the instability, similar to the argument Putin made about the Eurozone crisis, that even being a full member of the EU doesn't protect you from, you know, huge double-digit unemployment rates. You know, he's made his point about that. Beyond that, the damage that's being done now to infrastructure and business and confidence and relations with Russia, those are all bad things for Russia. The other thing that's changed, though, is, you know, Putin's relationship with Yanukovych. They've always hated each other, but up till now, they could stomach each other and, you know, sort of hold their noses and hold hands and, you know, walk down the path. It appears now that the signals coming from the Kremlin are that they're ready to cut him loose. And mostly, I think it's because they see him as ineffective, that, you know, even given the bailout, this $15 billion from the Russians and forgiveness of some of the debt and discounted gas prices and Russia's kind of trying at least to fend off Western intervention ostensibly on behalf of the authorities in Ukraine, Yanukovych still is so incompetent that he's unable to put out this fire without making it worse in the process. And that's, you know, that would be why you have talk now coming from the Kremlin that he's like Ceausescu. He's going to go and, you know, it's just as well.
But you were saying earlier, Matthew Rzhensky, that shuffling the deck, at the end of the day, you end up disappointed. That particularly was the case with the so-called democratic leader who was poisoned by the, at least assumption is by the Russians.
Yushchenko.
Yeah. And then now he's living in a government residence, apparently, on the take from Yanukovych, or at least.
Sure.
I mean, it's disgraceful, you know.
Yeah. I mean, everyone, how do I put this delicately, if you put your faith in individual political leaders in this kind of kleptocratic post-Soviet systemic context, you will be disappointed. I think that's why we really need to focus not on, you know, a handful of opposition politicians who will be the saviors of Ukraine, or even a few thousand demonstrators who are willing to make very dramatic sacrifices for noble reasons, but on the real mass of Ukrainians. I'd love to see, these are not silver bullets, but I'd love to see more investment in exchange programs that bring Ukrainians to Europe so that they see what they're missing and they see what's possible and they see kind of real liberal democracy in action, warts and all. They understand how business can get done without bribery. And then I'd love to see some real grit and willingness to sacrifice on the part of tens of millions of people in non-melodramatic ways over a sustained period of time. All of that stuff is time-consuming and complicated, and heretofore, Ukrainians haven't really been willing to do it.
But, you know, this is not North Korea in the sense that North Koreans eventually get South Korean soap operas and that sort of unhinges them. I mean, they're right next door to Europe. They must know about the quality of life in the West.
Some of them do. Many of them. I'd say a couple million people who have visited at least Poland and maybe farther afield, but it's a country of 46 million people.
Right.
You have an older generation that has never left the borders of the old Soviet Union.
Right.
I think you have people who are deeply cynical because all they've seen in their daily lives is one after another local, regional, or national government that exists not to serve the people but to steal from them. And why should they assume that there's something magically different, by bringing this thing called democracy or this thing called rule of law? Laws exist to be exploited and dodged. That's the old Soviet tradition.
So what about Yulia Tymoshenko, the opposition leader that's jailed? Would she be in the category of a potential disappointment?
I think she's already been a disappointment. Remember,
right.
She was prime minister.
And they just fought amongst themselves. That's all they did, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. She enriched herself and her immediate allies. I mean, one of her closest allies, Pavlo Lazarenko, ended up in prison in the United States for a decade for money laundering. Mm-hmm. And whose money was he laundering, right?
Right.
I mean, you can look up the record of that trial. But, bottom line is Tymoshenko, remains in prison. She has not been at the centerpiece of this movement at all. Her former deputy, Yatsenyuk, is to a greater extent, but he has very little interest, frankly, in seeing her come back because that will eclipse his place. And, you know, the statements that she's issued, I'm not terribly encouraged by them because she says things like, keep fighting, don't give up. If you don't get rid of Yanukovych, all is lost. You know, with no mention whatsoever of use peaceful means, let's seek compromise, let's end the violence. You know, that scares me.
So why is the EU then making her release a condition if she's so corrupt?
Well, I don't know that condition is anymore at the center of the EU's demands. That was the case back in November when they thought that Ukraine would sign the association agreement. And even then, frankly, at the last minute, it looked like the EU would be prepared to back down on that if Ukraine would just sign.
Well, just in closing, Matthew Rodzianski, with government snipers now picking off demonstrators and the real possibility you've got police either defecting to the opposition or their police stations in the West have been raided, some troops have turned over. The military, I think, doesn't want to get involved, and that's probably why the general got fired. But do you think that there is any way to stop the escalation towards this becoming a shooting match?
I think the only good way, the only right way to proceed is going to be through the process that we already know, which is you have to find a Band-Aid to stop the bleeding right away. You have to call a truce in it, and somehow both sides have got to have enough discipline to recognize that they can't negotiate in good faith if they're going to break the terms of the truce. So that's the most immediately urgent thing. And then you've got to persuade, and this can involve pressure from the outside, including the United States. You've got to persuade the opposition that they have to be amenable to compromise, that they are not going to get everything that they want, and they are not going to disenfranchise, you know, millions of Ukrainians who still support Yanukovych. And then you've got to obviously convince the regime that they have something to lose. that, in fact, this is not an end game where if they compromise with the opposition, they're going to be Timoshenko'd. They're going to get thrown into prison, and that's the end for them, because then they'll just fight until the very end.
Well, Matthew Rodzinski, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rodzinski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian regions. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russian and Eurasian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the ousting of the head of Nigeria's central bank, who blew the whistle on a missing $20 billion in oil revenues. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies, career Foreign Service Officer, and former Ambassador to Nigeria. Previously, he was political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. And his book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, is now in its second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Campbell.
Thank you.
And the reports out of Nigeria that the head of the central bank has been ousted have been somewhat facile, because they say because of $20 billion that are missing. But it's pretty clear that the central banker who just got railroaded, he's the whistleblower, isn't he? I mean, he's saying that $20 billion of oil revenues at the rate of about $1 billion a month have disappeared.
That's correct. That is exactly what he is saying. And this has provoked a good deal of anger, both from the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, a state-owned corporation that is involved in oil production, and also the Office of the President of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan.
So the oil company itself, the state-owned oil company, apparently is fairly opaque in its accounting. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. It's extremely opaque in its accounting, and public finance in general in Nigeria is opaque. Lamido Sanusi has an excellent reputation in the international financial community because of banking reforms that he has introduced over the past several years. And, in fact, he has been named Central Banker of the Year twice by a UK publication that is, in fact, owned by the Financial Times.
The Banker magazine.
Yes.
So I think we can safely say he's the good guy in this, right?
I think we can, yes.
So who are the bad guys?
Well, the bad guys, from my perspective, it's not so much that they're bad guys as rather their behavior is perplexing. Sanusi has been, quote, suspended, unquote, because as part of an effort to guarantee the independence of the central bank, the governor can only be removed by the Senate. They're not the votes there to remove him, and beyond that, the Senate could remove him only for cause, and no real cause has been shown. So he's been suspended until his term runs out in June. Not clear to me that suspension is legal, And Sanusi himself has said that he will contest it in the courts. Sanusi, operating, I think, from an important point of principle, maintains that what is really important here is that the independence of the central bank be maintained, that, in other words, the central bank not be subject to political interference. And that's why he's going to court in order to try to overturn his suspension.
But it would seem, though, that whistleblowers do not get very far in Nigeria, particularly when they try to tackle corruption. In 2007, Nuhu Ribadu was suspended as the head of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission for trying to do his job. It sounds like the central banker is also trying to do his job, or at least asking where has the money gone. And this is the people's money, right? $20 billion.
It certainly seems to me that it's that way, that what Lamido Sanusi was doing is what the governor of the central bank ought to be doing, calling to the president's attention the fact that there's $20 billion that's not accounted for. And yes, it's perfectly true that whistleblowers, people who take on corruption in Nigeria, often do not fare well. There is speculation, and I caution that it is speculation, but there's speculation on the street in Nigeria that Sanusi may well make further revelations about corruption that he has uncovered.
Again, I'm speaking with John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies, career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria. He was political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, is now in its second edition. So getting back to the state-owned oil company and its opacity in terms of its finances and in terms of who really is in charge, and if all this money is sort of trickling out of the oil sector, clearly there are vested interests. So do we know who these vested interests are that are opposed to the central banker shedding some light on what they're up to?
No, we don't know them. We don't know them by name. But as you say, it would appear highly likely that very senior personalities in Nigeria are involved either directly or indirectly.
And how do you account in terms of the nation's patrimony here, in terms of money that comes in from its major export, oil? And it's one of the world's biggest exporters of oil. Do we really know how much is exported per year? I mean, you could be able to calculate it if you knew. And I take it there's also this phenomenon going on in Nigeria of, you know, bootleg oil being stolen, siphoned off, and sold on the black market. So can you sort of walk us through the economics of oil production in...
What you're saying is correct. And Sanusi himself has said publicly that it's not really known exactly how much of Nigeria's oil is produced in any given month and how much of it is sold and how much of it is stolen. None of these figures are known with any kind of precision. We normally say that Nigeria is at present producing a bit more than 1 million barrels of oil a day. That's a lot of money. And oil revenue amounts to more than 90% of Nigeria's foreign exchange and more than 70% of the government's total revenue. So you're talking about something that's a big deal.
Well, though, you would think that the foreign oil buyers, and Shell, I believe, is a big player there, they would at least have the accounting, or do they prefer to, you know, if they are they involved in also buying black market oil?
I don't think any of the oil majors are involved in buying black market oil. The damage to their reputation would be too great.
But why can't we get figures from them then?
Well, the issue is considerably more complicated than that. The oil is produced in either by joint venture or by joint agreement between the international oil companies and the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. This means that Shell can, for example, or any of the other major oil companies, can tell you precisely how much they produce, but they can't tell you how much is produced across the board. And there are many domestic oil producers as well.
I see. Well, it turns out there that Sanusi's original letter that was leaked in December, he said that 50 billion in oil revenues is missing in a pack.
Well, he did indeed. And as far as I can tell, and I must say the whole matter is extremely opaque, but as far as I can tell, 30 billion of that has been found and accounted for, but that still leaves 20 billion.
I see. So tell us about the president then, good luck, Jonathan. He is a protege of the former president who was notoriously corrupt, was he not?
He was a protege of General Olusegun Obasanjo.
Right.
And though they have since broken, former President Obasanjo has been bitterly critical of President Goodluck Jonathan's apparent ambitions to run for re-election in 2015.
Right.
I say apparent because, in fact, while he is behaving as though he's going to run, he hasn't, in fact, announced that he's going to do so.
I see. Well, perhaps I'm confusing Obasanjo with his predecessor, General Sani Abacha, who was notoriously corrupt.
He was indeed notoriously corrupt.
I believe they found in one of his many palaces, they broke down a wall and found a hidden room full of currency.
Don't know specifically. There are lots and lots of stories like that on the street. But the fact remains, he was indeed notoriously corrupt. And some of the funds that he looted, have been recovered, but only some.
Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is a country undergoing a civil war of sorts, is it not?
Correct.
This insurgency called Boko Haram, the insurgency from the north, and it does seem that the Nigerian military recently suggested that they'd routed Boko Haram, and then the next day, almost, Boko Haram set off a bunch of suicide bombs to make it clear that they haven't gone away.
That's correct. I myself treat with extreme skepticism Nigerian military claims that they are bringing the situation in the north under control. There are also two other hot spots that I think are worth mentioning. The first is in the middle of the country, where there is considerable ethnic and religious conflict, basically between Fulani herdsmen who are Muslim and Christian Barone farmers. That can flare up at any time, and the government has been remarkably unsuccessful in controlling it. And then in the oil patch itself, which is where Jonathan comes from, certain militant leaders there have threatened mayhem if Jonathan is either prevented from running for the presidency or if he does run and is defeated. So you've got three areas that you've got to watch from a security perspective.
But in the Delta itself, where all the oil comes from, isn't there a group called MEND, a rebel group?
There is indeed. And there was an amnesty established in 2009 by Jonathan's predecessor and continued by Jonathan. And some of the leaders of MEND have been incorporated into Jonathan's administration.
Well, I've seen pictures of these guys with bandoliers of machine gun bullets and flying, tooling around in speedboats with heavy machine guns.
Right.
Apparently. I mean, if those guys have made their way into government, that's quite a transition.
Isn't it?
So if I were a Nigerian, I think I'd be pretty disgusted with my government, wouldn't you? I mean,
well, and a great many of them are, and they're not shy about saying so.
Right.
Nigeria has virtually absolute freedom of speech, and there is lots and lots of criticism of governance writ large in Nigeria right now.
But I take it you can, grouse about it, but you can't do anything about it? Is that the situation?
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy. It's very difficult to change fundamentally the political economy of a country. And of course, they're looking towards national elections literally a year from now, mid-February of 2015. Run-ups to elections in Nigeria are often periods of instability and considerable violence.
So, and that's on top of the ongoing violence in this Muslim-Christian divide.
That's right. Now, but there may be, it may be related. In other words, you can have violence cross over from being essentially political to igniting ethnic and religious conflicts.
So what is the connection then with this insurgency from Boko Haram? I mean, they seem to be antediluvian, aren't they? They're against education. What is their agenda?
Well, first of all, we have to be careful about using the word Boko Haram to describe what is clearly a highly diffuse and multifaceted sort of grassroots insurrection against the Nigerian political economy. One part of it, led by Abubakar Shekau and consisting of the followers of a charismatic Islamic preacher who was murdered by the police, one part of it, properly speaking, is Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. But there are other groups that that are so labeled and share the kind of Islamic jihadist vocabulary that Boko Haram uses. It's difficult, though, to sort out what is political, what is criminal, what is religious about this insurrection. And the particular causes of it are often intensely local. In other words, it will vary from village to village.
But is it, at the end of the day, do you have a divide between a largely Christian South and a Muslim North? Is that,
yes.
And that's not reconcilable, that divide?
It is reconcilable, and through most of Nigeria's history, it has been reconciled. One of the devices for doing it was so-called power alternation, or zoning. That was where the presidency would alternate between the Christian South and the Muslim North. But what Jonathan did was he set aside that that general approach when he ran for the presidency in 2011, and it was generally regarded as the Muslim North's turn.
I see. So they feel alienated at the moment, and that gives a fertile field for the Boko Haram types, I take it.
That's exactly right. And fertile field is the right way to put it, and because we're talking about something which is diffuse and local, and it is difficult to apply systematic categories to it.
So just in closing then, John Campbell, getting back to the oil issue and the missing, it started out with $50 billion and they found apparently $30 billion, but there's still $20 billion missing from the state oil company. And this is only over a period of what, wasn't the bleeding at the rate of $1 billion a month?
I think that's what I have in mind. Though I would have to verify
right.
that.
But so presumably this could have gone back for decades, right? The bleeding?
I could have, but I think it's unlikely that it did. We're talking enormous amounts of money, and I don't think you could have sums that large disappear over a decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, but during Abacha's period, he just took it all, right?
I mean, he did indeed. Yes.
Yeah. So since his tenure with the mentor of Goodluck Jonathan, he was relatively clean, was he? Obasanjo?
Obasanjo provided governance that was considerably more skillful than that of either Abacha or of Jonathan. His administration worked much better. You didn't have an insurrection in the north. You didn't. He managed to get the ethnic conflict in the Middle Belt under some kind of control. Not so much in the Delta. He wasn't particularly successful there. But the level of governance was considerably stronger under Obasanjo than it is now.
Well, I just come across the figures now. earlier this month, Mr. Sanusi, the central banker, has just been eased out or suspended or fired, or we're not quite sure. Certainly not, it's not been done legally. He told a Senate committee that out of the $67 billion in oil sold between January of 2012 and July of 2013, $20 billion had not been accounted for. So that gives us an idea of the kind of revenues. That's a huge chunk. That's over 30%.
That's a huge chunk, and it's a huge chunk of revenue in an extremely poor country.
Well, I must say, it is a bit disgusting, isn't it?
Discouraging.
Discouraging. Okay, we'll settle on that. And I thank you for joining us, John Campbell.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies, a career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria. He was political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his book, Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, is now in its second edition. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the president's decision to drop the chain CPI Social Security cuts from his 2015 budget.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric Kingston, who is a professor of social work at Syracuse University, who served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982 to 1983 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. He is also founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launched and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Kingston.
Great to be back, Ian. Thank you.
And I take it that it's good news, as far as you're concerned, that President Obama will not include cuts to Social Security in the 2015 White House budget.
Absolutely excellent news. We're very happy the president has aligned himself with, frankly, the will of the American people.
So is this to say, though, that chain CPI is dead? Because they haven't put it in the budget, but a White House spokesman said it still could be on the table. So what's your understanding of that?
Well, I don't think there's much of a chance that there's going to be a table with Republicans proposing to raise taxes. So I think it's certainly dead until after the midterm elections, the November elections this year.
But isn't this budget that we're talking about circumscribed by the proposals under this two-year bipartisan spending agreement reached in December between Senator Patty Murray and Representative Paul Ryan?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what is the president proposing here in terms of what he's offering?
I haven't looked totally at what's coming out, but I think he's pivoted toward away from austerity and towards developing proposals that would move the economy forward. His minimum wage decisions are there. He doesn't have legislation on that, but he's moving much more assertively towards addressing some of the unemployment problems we're all facing.
Well, apparently he has a $56 billion proposal called Opportunity, Growth, and Security Initiative, which largely is to do with education initiatives with the universal pre-kindergarten. And do you think he's going to embrace what Elizabeth Warren's saying? It's not just a question of not having this chain CPI, but she's saying that you need to bolster Social Security. You need to seniors are having a hard time. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, yes. I think I'd say two things. One, I think the president is putting forward a budget and a vision of more spending on social needs, on social investments, and educational investments. At the same time, you know, he has acknowledged that the chain CPI is not a proposal that his party is in favor of, and he says he never really was in favor of it. It was mainly a Republican proposal, so we're happy to let that stand. I don't know. I would hope that the president would follow up what he's done, what he said in the State of the Union address a couple of weeks ago. He made it clear that he understands that Social Security for many seniors, many people with disabilities, is not sufficient to maintain a reasonable standard of living. He hasn't followed that up with any proposals to increase benefits, but I think it opens the door and it highlights what Elizabeth Warren, what really a moderate Senator Begich from Alaska has been saying, what Tom Harkin and Bernie Sanders and many others have started to say, that we have a retirement income crisis in the country, and we have to start thinking about dealing with it. And when you think about what we need to do, the most logical thing to do is expand Social Security benefits. This is the richest nation in the world. We can certainly afford to do more than have really, two-thirds of our working people today looking forward to a retirement where they can't maintain their standard of living.
But what about raising the caps? Because the wealthiest Americans pay pretty much the same as middle-class Americans.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, eliminating the cap is a very sensible thing to do. It would address a good chunk of the projected 80-90% of this projected shortfall. There are many other things we could do too. I would go much further personally than simply raising the cap. I would consider, I would propose putting a tax on people who make $1 million or more, on the million and first dollar and beyond. Have them pay 10% on all earnings above $1 million, and direct that towards strengthening the Social Security program and enabling us to expand benefits. Senator Harkin doesn't go that far, but he has a proposal which would, in fact, expand benefits about $70 or so a month, and also address a lot of the projected shortfall, and would also come up with a fairer and better cost of living adjustment for everybody. Right now, you know, it's good. The president, the White House put forward with, you know, picked up on a Republican proposal, but they embraced this idea of the chain CPI, and at first they were saying it's a better way of measuring inflation. Over time, I think it became clear to just about everyone, or large numbers of people, it's not a better way of measuring inflation, but it's a stealth-like way to cut benefits. And they've moved away from it, and that's good. The reality is that the cost of living adjustments for older people, people with disabilities, do not keep up with inflation, and we should have a way of measuring inflation that doesn't overstate or understate the impact of the cost of living, just assures that benefits maintain their purchasing power. Tom Harkin's bill, Senator Begich, a number of others have been very, very supportive of something called the CPIE, but basically a fairer way of measuring cost of living. And so I think those are very realistic things. Frankly, I'd go further. I think of Social Security as an institution that's here to help us all progress as a society. There are many young people who are contributing into the system, and one of the great risks that American families face, that hardly any other nation's, industrial nation's families face, is a lack of support of wages if they have to leave work because of illness, or if they have to leave work to care for a very aged parent or a very sick child or a very sick spouse. Having some kind of modest family leave benefit, not just assuring that people can go back to their jobs as they leave to care for someone or themselves, but a benefit that supports the loss of wages in that kind of period. That's something this country can do, and it would align us with virtually every other industrial nation in the world. So I think we should start, I think it's time to start thinking expansively in this, of how to use this system that is really our system to address major problems American families face, to address the retirement income crisis, and to do it in a way that where we all may contribute more, but we especially, as people who've won the lottery in the past 20 years, to pay their fair share.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Kingston, who's a professor of social work at Syracuse University, who served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982 to 1983 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. He's also the founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launched and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. So I guess in this election year, the president is not trying to reach out to the Republicans and being rejected as he was by offering up the changed CPI, and even then they wouldn't play ball. And it's but still he made compromises. He's made compromises in the Patty Murray Ryan agreement. Unemployment's been cut. You know, they've tried to restore it for 1.3 million Americans, but that's gotten nowhere. Food stamps have been cut. It is going in the wrong direction as far as helping those in need, isn't it? And you've got this whole specter of why all this austerity was necessary, which was the so-called deficit. The deficit's going down to record levels at record speed. So, I mean, why not turn the debate around and start talking about real stuff instead of pandering to these scare tactics?
I hope that will happen. I think it's going to happen with members of the House and the Senate. I guess I want to do two things here. One, I compliment the White House for having backed away from the chained CPI. And I don't think they ever loved the idea, but they certainly saw it as an option they were very willing to push, and I think it was a very bad idea. But they aren't doing that now, and I'm pleased about that. And I have to say, I think it's a victory for all the organizations, for all the citizen voices that came in and said, don't cut these benefits, whether the AFL-CIO, the Alliance for Retired Americans, many people, organizations and the coalitions we're part of, worked very hard to block cuts to Social Security, and I think working together, everyone was effective, and that's good. But I agree with you, that's not enough. We need to be talking about pivoting and putting some real issues front and center on the nation's agenda. The cuts to food stamps are outrageous. The long-term unemployment, when our unemployment rates, the long-term unemployment rates are much higher than they were in any other recession when we stopped long-term unemployment insurance. This is outrageous. There's been a nastiness in our society where we start blaming people who are unemployed, blaming people because they need food stamps, and that has to stop. And I would love to see our president, who has the bully pulpit, speak far more forcefully than he has spoken about issues concerning inequality, but also about issues affecting poor people. The word poor is not a dirty word, but we haven't been using it in our political lexicon. The word anti-poverty is not a dirty word. We need to be thinking about that, I think, at the same time we're thinking about maintaining protections for the middle class. Just sort of add one more thing here. The president was also responding to tremendous pressure by members of the Congress, the House, and the Senate, who have pushed very hard to move the chained CPI out of his budget. So I think I'm going to give the White House credit, but it doesn't hurt that 117 members the day before yesterday signed a letter to the president saying, 117 members of the House saying, please pull the chain CPI out of the budget. And it doesn't hurt that there have been direct discussions by members of the Senate with the White House, and that 16 members a few weeks ago signed a letter saying, do not cut Medicare, Social Security, or Medicaid. So this is all positive. I think many of those members are now moving forward with strong voices to talk about how to strengthen some of these programs. And so I guess the point you're, yes, huge compromises have been made, and compromises usually that harm the most vulnerable in our society, and that's wrong.
Well, just in closing, in this election year, will concern about the poor have traction? Because after all, the poor don't tend to vote. I understand that the middle class, there's some traction with the concern over growing income and wealth inequality. Do you expect both that to be an issue and helping the poor an issue in this election?
I don't know, but I'd like to see it. It's really helping hardworking low-wage workers for the most part who are poor. We have large numbers of people who work year-round, full-time year-round, and they're not able to maintain a reasonable standard of living. We have other people who are not able to work. I don't know, but I think, you know, when we think about deficits, I think the biggest deficit this country has faced in the last 5-6 years is a moral deficit. Our president has the capacity and at times the passion to speak to that deficit, to speak to the risks facing many Americans, middle class and low income. I don't know if he will. I think that if the party or anyone who aligns themselves with Social Security in this election is likely to do a whole lot better. This system is the system that is the difference between this last recession having been a total disaster for the American people and just having been really bad, horrible. Yeah. I think there's a benefit to candidates who are going to talk about expanding benefits, and I like to think that there's a value in talking about protecting working persons of all ages and non-working persons with programs like unemployment insurance or food stamps.
Well, Eric Kingston, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Eric Kingston, who is a professor of social work at Syracuse University. He served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982 to 1983 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. He's also the founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launched and staffs the Strength and Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.